Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Every year, in high schools all over America, students graduate having learned virtually nothing about history, economics, or politics. Then those students go on to college. Then those students make demands. For an example of this, we will use Occidental College in Los Angeles, California.
Occidental College students are camping out at the campus administration building to protest the school's handling of diversity issues.
So Friday is not necessarily the deadline when we want to leave, but the deadline when we expect our demands to be met.
Their 14 demands include the resignation of President Jonathan Veach, a new Black Studies major, and more diversity training.
It's been like very tense because there's been a lot of like questioning of like, okay, but what is actually going to happen to us?
Students have occupied the building for 3 days. Ward says they've at least captured the school's attention with responses from Veach and the Board of Trustees.
Getting these responses is like, it's the first step because usually what we, the biggest thing in our way is the bureaucracy. Like we get these like bureaucratic blockades, like we never know which channels to go through and we're never guided to them.
Occidental's Vice President of Marketing and Communications says Veach hears the students loud and clear.
He's committed to taking meaningful action on the student demands, but he wants to do it with them at the table.
Ward and many others say they're fed up with microaggressions experienced on a regular basis.
People touching my hair and me getting angry about that, being called like the N-word at parties, characterized as like aggressive.
I believe that the racism and the microaggressions that Asian Americans often face as the model minority stems from the same systems of power that also oppress the Black and Latinx communities as well.
Jeannie Wyatt is one of many white allies.
Like, I was complacent in the overall system for so long in my life because I went to an all-white high school. My parents are, like, very conservative and, like, let's be real, racist.
Students say they're prepared to camp out for as long as necessary, sacrificing creature comforts.
I've missed all of my classes. They've missed all of their classes.
But Wyatt says the cramped quarters have a familial vibe.
Yeah, it's definitely a unifying force. I've definitely learned a lot about myself.
I don't think there's ever been an event where we actually seen so many groups on campus in one space.
To accommodate protesting students, some professors are holding class inside and just outside the administration building. Students say they'll stay as long as they need to. For Annenberg TV News, I'm Helen Zhao.
Occidental students discuss their demands with the school's president, Jonathan Veach.
We simply can't meet every single demand on that list. But I can tell you that I will honor the conversation.
So resign!
And I do not cling to this job. I'm happy to resign.
Whoa! Occidental students also discuss their issues with the press. Kind of.
How does me being a reporter with a news outlet that is a different view, has different views, that aren't necessarily even my own all the time, reflect upon my being here as a reporter?
I mean, different views don't make students feel uncomfortable. Let's be that clear. It's not the different views.
Okay, so can I ask you a question? Okay, go ahead.
No, we're requesting that you respect the fact that this is a community-owned space by students. We're requesting you respect the fact that we have had strangers and people we don't know come in and out, and that there's an issue of safety. And right now, our request, right, considering the fact that this space is being occupied, is for you to please step out the
Regarding your issue of safety, I don't pose any kind of threat. I was here yesterday and the day before, and everyone was perfectly fine with my presence.
Did you ask
students have approached us?
I've had administrators actually say that you've engaged with them and that they feel uncomfortable engaging with you as well.
What did they say?
I've had actually administrators, I don't know if it's been you, but other folks in Freiburg have been here in the past, last couple days, and it's been very uncomfortable for the administrators as well. They do not want to engage with you. This is the student's story to tell. If they don't want you to be here, then I think that you should be able to respect it. As a journalist.
Please don't take any video of me.
as an objective journalist.
If you're going to take video of me, I'm going to take video of you guys too then. How about that?
Hey, so this is what
what's your name?
You were asking me for.
He was taking video of me. I mean,
this is actually part of the protocol of maintaining community safety.
What kind of well, you guys are also asking for security on the campus to remove their vests.
Yeah, I don't know how that's connected to this.
So, look, no, a little bit, because basically... No, it is a little...
We're not talking about militarization.
Yeah. No, it's militarization. Do I look like a military person? Do I look like I have any kind of thing on me?
People feeling unsafe with your presence here? Has
but how? Feeling unsafe how? I want to know how.
We don't owe you an explanation.
Whoa! All of the audio that you've heard in the show so far was recorded in the latter half of the month of November. Many of you might be asking, what will the college's response be? It came 1 week ago. This from Reason.com. Occidental professors voting to give students power to report them for microaggressions. In recognition of their complicity in, quote, structural racism and oppression, unquote, at Occidental College, the faculty will vote on a resolution that mandates diversity training, requires all academic departments to make racial sensitivity a component of in-class instruction, and allow students to, quote, report microaggressions, unquote, between students and professors. The proposal, dubbed the Plan of Action, was created by Occidental's Faculty Council, which governs academic affairs on campus. Reason obtained a draft of the proposal, which will be presented to the entire Occidental faculty on Tuesday. From its introduction, quote, we recognize and are inspired by the leadership of Oxy United for Black Liberation and their call for widespread institutional changes in the culture of the college. We affirm that Black Lives Matter, and we also affirm the broader ideals of social justice to which their call speaks. We recognize that the structural racism and other forms of oppression of the college violate our commitment to ensuring equity and excellence in our educational programs for all our students. We also acknowledge that our collective inaction as a faculty body, makes us complicit in the failures of the college to make our mission a lived reality. For this, we apologize for failing you, our students. Unquote. The plan of action seems to be a response to recent protests on campus. Students occupied the administrative center and vowed not to leave unless Occidental President Jonathan Veach agreed to resign. They also want Occidental to hire more professors of color and fund new diversity initiatives. The students will get many of the things they want if the full faculty body approves the plan of action. The resolution would mandate diversity and ally training for all faculty beginning in January 2016. Quote, we will empower the dean of the college to ensure compliance, the plan reads. The plan also obligates professors to place a much greater emphasis on topics relating to race and ethnicity, even if they don't teach subjects that call for much examination of social or cultural issues. Quote, all departments must incorporate issues of cultural and racial identity and diversity in their curricula, the plan reads. Does all departments include mathematics, physical science? I imagine that it does. Perhaps most worrying, the plan calls for a microaggression monitoring system that would allow students to report faculty members for offending them. The plan explains that this is necessary to correct, quote, power imbalances between faculty and students. But will students have too much power if they are granted the right to be safe from microaggressions, which are, by their very nature, subjective and relatively inconsequential? How are the professors supposed to teach if they have to worry about being reported and investigated for unknowingly saying the wrong thing to a student? In an email to Reason, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education President, the acronym for that organization is FIRE, President Greg Lukianoff expressed numerous free speech concerns about the resolution. Here is FIRE's statement. Lightly edited. Quote, we are troubled by the new proposed faculty resolution at Occidental College as it requires speech policing, substitutes academic freedom and judgment with top-down ideological commitments, and stifles diversity of opinion in favor of imposed orthodoxy. Given that microaggressions can be unconscious and often exist in the eye of the beholder, the call to, quote, address and report professors' microaggressions creates a bottomless pit of speech policing. Mandatory diversity training of all faculty puts even seasoned professors in the position of being told what ideological assumptions they should or even must have. Academic freedom requires professors to follow their own research, where it takes them, regardless of the opinions of paid consultants. Finally, the requirement that all professors, even the hard science professors, incorporate issues of cultural and racial identity and diversity in their curricula violates basic tenets of academic freedom and scholarly independence. That's the end of the email. FIRE vowed to challenge the proposal if it is adopted by the faculty. Neither Occidental College nor Faculty Council Chair Anthony Chase immediately responded to a request for comment. The end, for now anyway, and my guest today happens to be a faculty member at Occidental College. Holy smokes, I can't wait to hear what he has to say about all of this.
If you want to, we can leave your friends behind. Cause your friends don't dance, and if they don't dance, well, they're no friends of mine. And say, we can go where we want to, a place where they will never find. And we can act like we come from out of this world, leave the real one far behind. And we can dance. If we want to, if we don't, nobody will. And we can act real rude and totally removed, and I can act like an imbecile. Say, we can dance, everything's out of control. And we can dance, we're doing it from pole to pole.
I think that introduction was way too sensationalist, and I don't think it properly sets the tone for what you're going to hear in this show today. So, you've seen the title, you've seen the guest, you know the issue, you've been following this in the news for the last couple weeks, I'm sure. What do you want to get out of today's show? How do you want to feel at the end of it? Yeah, we're going to start again. Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is December 1st, and today on the show, an issue that I have strategically avoided until this very episode. And there's a reason why. Every time I think about, you know, these events at places like Yale, what just happened at Dartmouth in the library, what happened at the University of Missouri, copycat incidents at places like Claremont, McKenna, how do these things make you feel? They make me feel angry. You're going to hear me use the word retard in the show today. But I don't want to be angry. I don't want to communicate anger on this show. I don't want to do a fear-based us and them kind of narrative, even though, man, there is a demand for that right now, huh? So I try to put myself into, you know, different pairs of shoes that walk on these campuses, and it's an incredibly challenging thing to do, especially when race comes into the mix. I'll tell you this, when I was 20, I was an idiot. Now, there I go again with overly simplistic language to describe my 20-year-old self. Hold that thought. We'll come back to that. Now, we talk on this show all the time about how these young kids have this genius, you know, little children. And obviously, I still stand by that. But after 15,000 hours of government school, there are some vulnerabilities that they need to be aware of. And I think there was this attraction for a lot of liberty-minded people to some of these movements early on, especially, you know, Black Lives Matter taking on police abuse. But lately, especially over the last couple months, I've realized that I don't want to be high-fiving people who are just operating outside of the establishment or fighting against it. I mean, that should be obvious. That should go without saying, because some of them are just too dangerous and ill-conceived. But I do want to engage with them. Like I said, When I was 20, I was an idiot. And I want to say to them, you are highly at risk of being an idiot too, Ivy League college student. Now again, same problem. What I just communicated to you there in 5 seconds is a much longer conversation in real life. You can't say, hey, you know, I used to be an idiot. I'm worried you might be one too, right? We all know how that's going to go. If you approach it like that, that's a 2-second conversation. It's like, you think I'm an idiot? You're an idiot, okay? And that's the end of your relationship with that person. So again, more detail. Now, when I was 20, I was in the process of being emboldened by this left-wing, agenda-driven version of history. And the conclusion that I formed in the middle of that process was, great, I'm smarter than everyone. Because there's a lot of important historical truths in that narrative. But man, was I naive then. I was naive 5 years later, even as I started to use the internet to build history curricula to teach in private school. I was only doing it for the purpose of confirmation bias. And holy crap, guess what? I think I'm even being pretty naive right now, thinking that there is a possibility for dialogue with some of these groups. Maybe that's what you're thinking. Don't be so naive, Brett. They don't want to talk to you. Haven't you seen the videos? Whether we're talking about the race issues or the gender issues, etc. They're not interested in engaging with you, especially not in one of their protest situations, because they see an outsider wanting to engage as an attempt to derail whatever they're doing. That seems to be, you know, common belief. But you know what? That's a whole other exploration, probably for a different show. Let's return to younger naive me. Today, when you look at the popularity of websites like Huffington Post, Slate, or Salon, or What Trends on Twitter, these are considered to be news websites by millions of people. And they are dictating many of the conversations that go on about important issues in this country. The people who write for those sites that I mentioned, or who ultimately determine what trends on Twitter a lot of the time, they're like 20-year-old me. Young men and women who went from college to the Huffington Post without a day in the real world. And it's really, really frustrating to see, because this is poor, and because this narrative, these naive, divisive narratives that come from these young people in college who have been given lots of very memorable and troubling pieces of historical information that have not been integrated yet into a larger context, are pouring down into the mindsets and the worldviews of people who are even younger. It's a lot to be angry about. And anger is very seductive. In fact, today is like the first day that I feel like I can speak to you about what's going on in these colleges without just sounding super pissy. At times, I'm going to sound moderately pissy. I'm fighting a good deal of pissiness right now. Let's continue and see how it goes. I want you to know I'm trying. I mean, I think if we look at the social justice war, I'm going to use that term, and I'm going to try not to be derisive here. The war has 4 fronts that I can identify. Race, which is basically the focal point of our show today. Feminism. LGBT sensitivity. Cultural sensitivity. And if you want to add a bonus, a fifth, anti-ableist insensitivity, which I was guilty of. When I used the word retard in my conversation with Thaddeus. Okay, so I failed at not being derisive. Sorry. But all these fronts of this war, all extremely co-optable, and I think we're starting to see that now in the 2016 presidential election, especially with Black Lives Matter, but all with valid needs and concerns at their roots. And it's observing the videos at places like Yale, Dartmouth, and Missouri that activate the conspiracy theorist mindset in me to think like this has to be by design. Not that all the people that we're seeing in these videos are conspirators, but they're getting some kind of activist training that is designed to create division, that is designed to shut down critical thinking. Or, as you'll hear me say to Thaddeus in the conversation, is this just, for me, the vindicating evidence of the output of 15,000 hours of government school? When you are done, this is how you will think. This is how you will communicate. I really can't even, you know, do a victory lap there because that's way too collectivistic, an assessment of what we're seeing. We are seeing a small, very, very vocal group of people who are behaving in a way that creates division, that takes the valid needs and concerns at the roots of these issues and makes people who would be sympathetic to those causes associate them with people who are fucking assholes. And there's just this the seeds of a suspicion that in some way that might be a Rules for Radicals type design. Or is it this? Is this just an overly enthusiastic rejection of one of the things that Thad railed against the last time he was on the show to talk about NWA, where Black Lives Matter came up and he said, this is the rejection of respectability politics? Are they simply rejecting respectability politics in a way that just appears to be to us a little overzealous? I don't know the answer. I'm intrigued by all of this. But when I feel myself getting angry, I want to find compassion for what's going on here. But if you don't have information, you can't do that. You see something you don't understand, you say, bah, fucking idiots. Even if I'm ultimately going to be the opponent of these people, these persons, you know, when it's revealed that they're all Marxists or whatever, I ask myself, how can I first understand their position so I can be a smart and formidable opponent? And one who I really hope, can't just be dismissed as a neo-reactionary or an MRA or a racist or a bigot or whatever. Now, what I'm about to say is not diplomatic. It's not compassionate. I would say it's even beneath me. But most of what I'm seeing in these videos, and I understand that is a small selection, there's this very vocal part of me that feels like saying, hey, your biggest problem appears to be that you suck. Again, what I feel like saying. You suck as an individual, not as a race, not as a gender, not as a culture. You are sucking all by yourself. Now, couldn't be more dismissive than that, could I? So to flesh that out a little bit better, it is to say, you evidence poor critical thinking skills. You evidence poor problem-solving skills and communication skills. You suck at those things, from my observations. And how can I help? You know, can I diagnose you? Because understandably, that creates a bad feeling in you, and you're looking to externalize that feeling, to direct it at some kind of oppressor who is to blame. And let's not just pin it to this dialogue or this controversy. Let's make that more general. It starts with the observation that life is hard, and then the follow-up question, whose fault is it? And there's a very, very dangerous kind of new culture being built around that observation and that inquiry, if it hasn't existed all along. Now, I will relate this to my experience dealing with people who identify as libertarians here in New Hampshire. Are you ready for this? This is going to be controversial. Now, this is a lot to process, so let me just slow down for a minute and clarify what the goals are. We want to understand what's going on here. And so I ask myself, as a libertarian, what have been some of the obstacles to my understanding, or what have I observed being obstacles for other people? And this is broader than these social justice issues. I'm talking about, you know, my development generally over the last decade. What I'm trying to draw attention to right now is loaded language or snarl words, anything that can be used to dismiss the expression of problems or concerns through one word or one phrase. Social justice warrior and racist are two examples. So if you spent time with liberty-minded people, say here in New Hampshire, you might have noticed that some of them, we're only talking about some, we're not making general rules for anybody in this show, of course not. What are we, insane? Some libertarians blame the state or the sleepwalking masses for all of the world's ills and many of their own problems as individuals. I've seen it. They have snarl words like statists, muggles. Oh, God. Sheeple. I don't hang around with anyone who calls anyone sheeple, but that word is definitely out there. Loaded language leads to a lack of clarity in thinking, and a lack of clarity in thinking leads to incautious and impractical actions. So I think about maybe some of my observations in New Hampshire related to activists dealing with the police, let's say in Keene. There's lots of video coverage of these types of interactions or altercations thanks to a site called Free Keene. Now, I want to be clear. I want to say up front, I am not changing any of my stance on the illegitimacy of government policing, especially considering what it has deteriorated into, largely because of the drug war. So in no way is this a defense of the police. But you see these videos. This was kind of a common theme where a police officer or a bureaucrat would be antagonized by a single activist or a group of activists, provoked, often in the form of like grating questions. Like, do you really think it's okay for you to do this? Do you really? How do you sleep at night when you are doing this? Those kinds of things. Or often in a completely passive-aggressive fashion. Until that, let's just stick with police officers, acted out aggressively toward the activist, exposing the violence inherent in the system. Then, just like the police aggression, the activist response was all too predictable. It usually goes something like, oh my God, I'm just trying to ask a question. Look at what happens to me when I just ask a question. Now, let's talk some police facts. Most police operate under the assumption that their badges do grant them extra rights. Number one. Number two, these people are not scientists. There's been plenty of news coverage over police departments' reluctance to recruit people with high IQs because they will either question their work or get bored with their job. So most people who function as on-the-street police officers are average IQ, maybe even below average IQ. Even though there is a psychological skill set necessary for policing, most of these people, from my experience, evidence a low emotional intelligence, which is very visible when their authority is not immediately respected. They are triggered by this, and they often become increasingly hostile. That's number three, emotional intelligence. Number four, they exist in an insular community where negative and aggressive attitudes towards the public are reinforced by their peers. Those are four facts about the police. Now, that all sucks, but that's reality. The activists that I spoke of earlier have this naive presentation like the police should be held to a higher standard. Armed people who believe they are privileged, who don't think for themselves because it's a liability to their employment, should be held to a higher standard. So when they are antagonized by activists and they, you know, react aggressively, and there's no defense of this. I'm just saying there's an unfortunate cause and effect relationship here that exists that needs to be acknowledged and explored. And a whole exploration is missed, right? It's just reduced to the simplistic good and evil, black and white, victimizers and victimized, oppressors and oppressed. I articulated four problems that exist in modern policing that all need to be unpacked and examined, but that's completely skipped over by reducing it to good and evil. Because good and evil doesn't need a backstory. Remember what happened when they tried to do that with Star Wars? It was a disaster. But when that reduction is made, there's really nothing to be learned. Unclear thought, unwise action. And that unwise, maybe even in many cases unconscious action that is prevalent in too many different types of activist communities today is a kind of construction project. And what are they building? It is a culture of victimization. And in Keene, New Hampshire, I will call out Keene, New Hampshire, it has produced its own kind of insularity that has prevented any progress from happening there in years. We're victims of the police, we're victims of the state, we're victims of the sleepwalking masses in this town. And those types of grating and passive-aggressive interactions that were once used, perhaps strategically, to demonstrate the violence inherent in the system are now being employed in many situations where it's just ordinary people who think what they're doing is silly. 5 years ago, Keene was, for libertarian activists, a kind of mecca, if I may culturally appropriate. And now it's a cautionary tale. In other places, the stakes are higher. On these college campuses, whether the issue is race or gender or culture, we're seeing the exact same thing happening. A culture of victimization being built with its own unique vocabulary and censorship for speech or ideas that are uncomfortable. Forget cause and effect. Forget historical context. This is about good and evil. This is about oppressors and oppressed, and that's it. And if you have something to say that doesn't fit into that narrative that we want to push, you will be silenced and then exiled from our safe space. Shit, now I'm angry again. The whole purpose of this monologue was to relieve anger. No, you know what? That's not completely accurate. The purpose of this monologue was to set up a show that should have the effect of hopefully quieting some of the hostility that a lot of us feel towards what is going on at a lot of these college campuses right now. Even though today on the show, we really deal primarily with the issue of race, I originally imagined this as a much more expansive treatment of this topic, but we really centered it on race. And I think it's a good thing that we did, because Thad is able to put these current events into a larger historical context that I think is very, very valuable. When I feel a tremendous amount of hostility, I find that listening to people who are thoughtful, calm, and educated and experienced in the subject being discussed can have a very, very soothing effect. Ah, now many of you are saying, I don't want to be soothed, Brett. That's like more of that safe space BS. I think understanding starts with calm. It starts with control. It starts with a steady footing. And I understand the seductive power of anger. I feel that the anger and the hostility, a completely realistic reaction to what we've seen in the news and on YouTube. But I think it's only a starting point. I don't think it's a place to get stuck. I'm hoping it's something that we can build on. I'm hoping it's something that we can make useful. And I want to start today with a clip of something called The Glenn Show. Now, there's two participants. The first man who you're going to hear speak, his name is Glenn Lowry. He is a professor at Brown University. And the second man, John McWhorter, is a professor at Columbia University. These are both Ivy League schools. Both these men are Black. And the effect that this conversation, I'll link to it in the show notes. The whole thing is about an hour. I recommend it if you're interested in this issue or this issue is causing you strife. I felt a great relief after watching this, realizing how much thought and reason and concern is being applied to this situation that just looks like complete insanity if you're not careful about how you interface with it. After that, we'll move into my discussion with Thaddeus Russell, where he will offer some explanations for how this current, very troubling, very frustrating situation on some college campuses in America in 2015 came to be. Here we go.
As stewards of an institution which is built around the idea of open discourse and argument, effort to censor what's being expressed on behalf of protecting the feelings of somebody is a degradation of the institution. It's a small one.
Even
it's
when it comes to racism? But for these people, racism is the exception when it comes to these things. What is your argument to them?
Ray Kelly is not a racist. I'm prepared to say that. And by the way, I want to make the point. I don't think this can just be talked about in the abstract. I think we do have to get down the cases, okay? Mm-hmm. Policing New York City is a tough problem. People may disagree about how to do it. But because somebody wants to deploy stop, question, and frisk doesn't make them a racist, okay? I'm going to say it yet again. It doesn't make you a racist because you're pro-police, all right? Public safety in communities of color is a very serious problem. The Black Lives Matter movement have decided they don't want to discuss that, mm-hmm. all right? You and I both think that that's a mistake on their part. Mm-hmm. I think it's a mistake in principle as well as a mistake in terms of pragmatic politics, that you don't, in terms of logical consistency, that you don't want to talk about that. But somebody actually has to go and sweep up the mess that's being left in the streets of some of our communities of color by violent people who have weapons and who are prepared to use them against others who are defenseless in those communities and can't afford to move out the way most of the parents of these Ivy League college attending people will have done. Okay? Now, to debate what works is one thing. To decide from the comfort of the leafy green campus that the guy who actually has to sweep up the mess is a racist and therefore has no right to speak is an abomination, John. And to allow that to happen or to justify it as a member of a faculty or the administration of a university is a betrayal of the trust of what's been entrusted to you. These institutions are important. They're important as sites of deliberation and debate. Make an argument. Present some evidence. Don't throw a fit. And if you throw a fit, then I, as the responsible authority, are going to call you on it. That's a fit that you just threw. We are an institution of ideas and debate. We don't tolerate that here. Mm-hmm. So I have absolutely no sympathy for these youngsters who decide that because there's an idea that they can't handle or a circumstance about which they don't have anything useful to say, they're going to preempt discussion of it by throwing fits. Mm.
I agree with you.
Okay.
I agree with you that the university should be stronger. There should be no resignations. I don't think we're going to see it, but I think that the people in question, the presidents and chancellors and administrators, ideally would be stronger and would say some of these things. I don't think they should say it with your tone, and not just because people need to be polite and hold their little fingers up, but because I don't think that these students, and I'm not just saying this in order to avoid alienating them because we're having a public conversation. This is what I really believe. These students are not being as willfully obfuscatory as you're implying. They are sincerely under the impression that what we're talking about is something called racism. That's a word that is so overextended. There's a whole conversation we could have about the wisdom of the term institutional racism as opposed to calling the phenomenon something else. But that's for another day. The way the term is used, it's all they've ever heard. Remember, they're 19 and 20 years old. As far as they're concerned, there are things that are off the table. And I think that their impression that what's off the table is anything that offends you on a racialist basis is not crazy. It's just naive. And I think that our universities have become too namby-pamby. People are too afraid of their jobs. People are too afraid of how they're going to look on YouTube. And also, there are fundraising issues. People don't want to speak the truth, and so people just cave. That is a problem. But the students themselves have just drunk in a way of looking at things that you drink in when you're in college. I think we may be forgetting what it felt like. There are just certain cultural norms. And among them is the idea that racism is racism, and that's it. So I agree with you, but it's just that these students are not the ruffians that you seem to think. They're naive. That's my true feeling about these uprisings. It's not pretty to watch what they do with the naivete. And yes, some of them are drama queens. That's human nature. But it's not their fault that they have an overextended sense of what racism is, and therefore is off the table. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't agree with it, John. You can't split...
Glenn, very, very quickly, one very quick thing. This is what I mean, for example. When I was in college, many people would find this surprising, I thought that to be a Republican was to be evil. I barely knew anything about politics, but what you drink in from the second you hit the threshold of your dormitory is, especially if you're a black person, Republican, bad. And Ronald Reagan had just been elected, and so I just assumed it. I didn't question it. I was interested in language and music, not politics. I just assumed it. When I was in grad school, I had reasons to get to know some Republicans just by issues of proximity. And I gradually realized, wait a minute, a lot of these people are actually capable of making sense. But I would never have dreamed that I would have thought that when I was in college, because it was all I drank in. That's these students now. That's the sort of thing that I mean.
Yeah, well, that may be the students, but it ought not to be the faculty and the administration. I agree. I think that we have responsibilities that extend beyond making people feel comfortable.
We can dance if you want to. We can leave your friends behind. Because your friends don't dance, and if they don't dance, well, they're no friends of mine.
Where'd you go to school?
Southern Vermont College. You know, why don't we just start there with you asking me a question? I went to a small school. I was a freshman in 1995. I had no idea that any of this was ever going on. Because this is nothing new. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the movie PCU, right?
Seen pieces of it, yeah.
it's basically the same thing, but you know, it was 20 years ago. It was 1994.
Yeah.
With a Jeremy Piven, incidentally, who looks older net then than he does now, which is very curious. You know, I don't think I ever had any awareness of this. You know, this whole, I mean, this is very multifaceted, right? And this term social justice warrior is like a huge catch-all. But part of it is this white savior complex. Mm-hmm. I think that's a term you've used before. I never saw anything like that, I think, until Kony 2012. Right. But it's funny, when I saw it, it made me understand the progressive movement at the beginning of the 20th century much better, which I always just thought of as evil before that. You know, I didn't really have a very nuanced view until I saw like Jason Russell in Invisible Children. I was like, oh, that's kind of what that is. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it was enough of a similarity for me to grasp the progressive agenda a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But yeah, why don't we just start? I mean, I think I want to treat this like an introduction. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this. I know you are in the middle of a controversy where I think you'd like to be. And it's been the case for over a year, because I know when you did the Rogan show, it was the rape allegations controversy at Occidental. And now you've moved into this mandatory cultural sensitivity training. Is that what they're calling it?
Diversity training.
Is this term valid, first of all, social justice warrior?
I mean, it's an epithet. So, you know, I don't know how useful it is. I mean, I've used it a few times myself. I prefer to be a little more precise in our analysis of people and phenomena and ideologies. And that's sort of one of my major frustrations with the current climate on campuses and this particular iteration of, whether you want to call it political correctness or social justice, whatever, that there's a very imprecise analysis that goes on, which is, you know, that everything is what's called structural racism, which now really means almost nothing, because it's been applied to everything from apartheid South Africa to someone saying, where are you from? Mm-hmm. So I think what we need to do is look at some history. The college campus of 2015 is a very particular context. And this is another thing that I have a problem with, is that there's a lot of conflation going on. There is structural racism here, there, and everywhere, and it's all the same. And not only is Ferguson the same as Yale, but 2015 is the same as 1963, right? And 1853. It's very, very frustrating to me that we don't sort of draw distinctions between those times and places. Now, that's not to say that it is super awesome and perfect to be a black student on a mostly white campus in 2015. In fact, I think it is, I've always suspected and basically known, that it's quite difficult to be a black kid on a mostly white campus in the contemporary era. But what they experience, and I do think it is racism of a sort, is a very different animal than the racism that they're talking about. Very different thing.
Right.
The racism that they tend to talk about doesn't exist in respectable American discourse anymore. It is shunned, it is underground. It does exist in America, and you can see it almost entirely in anonymous forums, right?
Mm-hmm.
That tells you that it is driven underground, that it's not respectable, it's not tolerated. You will be punished severely, culturally, socially, and otherwise, if you utter the N-word. In fact, we now have to say the N-word, right? That's another example or piece of evidence that we live in a very different time in terms of racial politics. But what you hear from these college protests and from the piece that the TC left in general is that, you know, the structural racism today, they constantly link it to Alabama in the 1950s and to Georgia in the 1850s and to Jim Crow. So here, a quick history lesson. I don't know if we've done this on your show. I can't remember. I think not, but it's absolutely essential. So the kind of racism that they're talking about, historians generally refer to as scientific or classical racism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which is a very, very particular thing, which was invented. Most historians agree, although there's some debate about this, but most historians agree, and I certainly think so, was invented at about the time of the American Revolution, in the age of the revolutions, democratic revolutions in France, America, and elsewhere, in places where there was slavery. the argument goes that prior to that period, the late 18th century, there certainly were people who said not nice things about Africans, but there was no sort of systematic, coherent body of thought on race as a biological category. There was no systematic body of thought on race as races of people being distinct and being hierarchical, some races being better than others, and that those things were biologically determined, right?
Yep.
That's what happened beginning in about the 1770s, 1780s. And Thomas Jefferson was actually a main driver in that. He wrote Notes on the State of Virginia, which everyone should read, which is one of the first scientific racist tracts. He goes through sort of, you know, the skull size and the facial features and the behaviors of blacks, and says that this is evidence that they are a biologically distinct and inferior race and therefore should be slaves. At the very same time he's writing this stuff, what else is Thomas Jefferson doing? He's saying, very, very, very famously, all men are created equal.
Right.
Okay, so the argument is among historians is that Jefferson and his crew had to sort of overcome that contradiction, right? By saying all men are created equal and owning slaves, hello, what are we going to do here? So the argument goes that what they did to resolve that contradiction was invent scientific racism. Invent this system of this set of ideas that purportedly showed that a particular group of people that they just happened to enslave were biologically destined to be slaves, were biologically incapable of being men like the rest of us, were biologically incapable of being full citizens. If you buy that argument that it was invented then, there's some debate on this, but I'd say most historians who are serious about this question agree. And the guy who wrote the seminal book on this was David Brian Davis, a historian at Yale. That set of ideas, you know, phrenology, people who know about this, like the study of skull shapes and sizes, right? Mm-hmm. Which was this stuff, and physiognomy.
Yep.
That sort of system, scientific racism was developed beginning in the 1780s and 90s, and then really took off in the 19th century and peaked sort of at the turn of the 20th century and died or was replaced during World War II. So you see this massive explosion of scientists and social scientists at the most elite institutions in higher education, all the Ivies, writing book after book after book, explaining how this race and that race are different and inferior to the white race. Okay, so Harvard professors, Yale professors, all the rest of them. It is standard discourse in higher education. It's standard discourse among American intellectuals and by the 1920s among politicians.
Right.
And all of that was the justification for the 1924 National Origins Act, but immigration restriction law, which essentially cut off all immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, because by then white people we would consider to be white from those parts of the world were considered to be biologically distinct and inferior races. Okay, so scientific racism justified the radical restriction of immigration in 1924. Okay, World War II comes along. We fight the fascists. They're racists. We therefore have to demonize all of them in order to fight that war and everything they stand for. Racism, scientific racism, put forward, of course, by the Nazis, had to be demonized as well. So it became very difficult.
Right. Their plan of action was easy to demonize, obviously.
It became very difficult to be a public racist when we're fighting people who are very famously racists.
Right.
Along comes a new set of ideas, which we now call, I mean, we, like academics, call racial liberalism. And the seminal text, and this is all in my book, in Renegade History, the seminal text of racial liberalism was Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma, published in 1944. In which he argued, A, that black people were not biologically inferior, so that's the good part, but B, that they could and should be assimilated into American culture and society, right? So a scientific racist is by definition opposed to assimilation and integration because they believe, of course, that these people can't be integrated or assimilated. So they never tried to change the cultures of black people or other inferior races. They just left them be or tried to exclude them, right? Stay separate from them. So these racial liberals come along, and the good thing they do is demolish this idea that the human race is made up of distinct biological races and there's a hierarchy among them. The bad thing they do is say, following that, we not only can, but should integrate and assimilate them, right? Which of course is actually white supremacist because it presumes that the culture that they assimilate into is the dominant white one in the United States of America and Northern Europe.
Yeah, it's like imperialism, like giving them the gift of our culture.
It is absolutely cultural imperialism, right? All so right. That set of beliefs completely supplanted scientific racism in respectable discourse in the United States and in Europe, right? After World War II, you really couldn't be a scientific racist and hold a position in academia. It was difficult to win election. Even in the South, even the arch segregationists of the South in the 1950s and 60s, they didn't actually walk around saying nigger anymore. Even those guys didn't actually say nigger in public. It was actually not okay even for them to say it in public, right? It tells you a lot. I mean, it's a massive sea change, okay? And of course, this whole ethos of racial liberalism gives birth in part it gave birth to the civil rights movement, obviously. Brown v. Board of Education, which integrated the schools, was completely informed by racial liberalism and Gunnar Myrdal specifically. And it particularly took hold in higher education. And it has been essentially the dominant racial ideology in higher education to this day. Not the scientific racism of before World War II, but this new set of ideas, which contains within it not the idea that black people should be excluded and killed and lynched and enslaved, but that they should be made to become like us. And this is another part of racial liberalism, and Myrdal was very explicit about this, that we, white people, should be responsible for uplifting our black brothers and sisters because they can't do it themselves, because they've been so degraded by centuries of slavery and oppression that they can't do it by themselves. They must be lifted up by whites.
Right.
Whites bear the responsibility for raising them up to our standards. Which is paternalism. So paternalism, to me and many other people, I'm hardly the only person who's made this critique, paternalism is central to racial liberalism, right? Which is not racism in the sense of scientific racism. It actually does say that they can be lifted up, right?
Yeah.
They are biologically equal to us, but there's sort of you could call it a cultural racism, or perhaps white supremacy. It could be white supremacy, right? The assumption there is that our culture, the one of whites, is the one that is good, that everyone needs to rise into. So that's what these kids on campuses today are dealing with. What happens is, for about 50 years now, since World War II, right, there's actually been a demand by whites, to bring them into our schools. That's what Brown v. Board of Education was.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you read the decision of Brown v. Board of Education, it says, we have this whole class of people who have no interest in being Americans. They have no interest in serving in the military. They have no interest in working hard at their jobs because they've been excluded all these years, right? So the first thing we've got to do is get them into our schools to train them to become good Americans. Okay, so that's run through higher education as well ever since. There's been a major demand among white liberals who have run high institutions of higher education since then to get black people into our schools, right?
Yeah.
In part to assimilate them. Okay. So that's what happens now. These kids get plucked, really, out of these neighborhoods they live in that are mostly black, and put in these institutions that are mostly white and that culturally and historically are very white. So they end up being isolated in these places. And often the demand is so great for these to put these kids in here that the institutions are forced to lower their standards in terms of credentials for black students. You cannot get enough in to fill the quotas unless you lower standards in terms of SAT scores and grade point averages, right, to get them in. So what happens is, not all, but a large number of those kids are not prepared to function in a college. And so they often have a hard time or they fail. So the whole thing is clearly a recipe for disaster, and it's clearly a recipe in particular for tremendous resentment among Black students at these colleges. You can understand why they have tremendous rage. Now, I understand their demands and the grievances they make don't often match this, what I'm talking about, and that's my issue. But you have to begin with an understanding of why they might be pissed off.
That is such a valuable context. You know, like, I was really interested in talking to you about this because, you know, as I started to approach this issue and, you know, initially there was a lot of confusion, my first impulse is to think, well, 15,000 hours of these people being educated by the government, and here it is on display, the critical thinking and communication skills of some of the country's brightest and most socially aware students. If you look at what's happening now, this goes beyond race to Yale and the whole Halloween costume fiasco, but also Mizzou, also other Ivy League schools. Dartmouth just had an incident in their library with Black Lives Matter. And initially I'm saying, like, wow, talk about vindication for somebody who's running something called a School Sucks Project. That this is the output. This is what goes into the colleges. I'm not pinning it on race, but I understand that argument. When I found myself watching these videos, you know, I actually was in some ways intrigued. Like, what's the opposition to this? Because I kind of feel like there's a bunch of calm and rational people in the middle of this group of people, whether the issue is race or feminism. I don't mean to collectivize, but just for the sake of time, and I think there's some usefulness of the term social justice warrior, even though it's totally loaded language. It drives people to emotional thinking. It's way too much of a catch-all. But what's on the other side of this? The us polite, calm people who are watching them go back and forth with who? Not just in colleges, in Mizzou, and the supposed hicks in the back of pickup trucks, but also in places like Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter. And it looks like there's actually a movement of neo-reactionaries who embrace a lot of the old racial thinking, the historic racial thinking that you were talking about, and even reviving and even, you know, citing new studies, not just on, you know, scientific racism based on phrenology, but scientific race differences based on things like IQ. Like, all this is pouring back into the conversation now, including very, very blatant racial divisions and racism as a response, as an unintended consequence to just the total shit tactics of these people on college campuses. It's like, you know, I understand that there's a legitimacy of concern with some of these issues. And you laid all that out. You know, you explain why it's difficult for a lot of these people, especially if we just want to focus on the race issue in college, why it's difficult for a lot of these people to find themselves in those situations with those pressures. They have valid concerns. But the entire concern winds up being dismissed because the people expressing the concern can't help but act like retards. And I'm sorry, I'm keeping that word. I'm keeping that. We need that, I think. for certain types of behavior. Thank you. Thanks for accepting that. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, we haven't fully fleshed this out, though. I mean, so you're this Black kid who gets offered this scholarship, right, mm-hmm. to Yale, Dartmouth, wherever, Occidental, where I teach.
Right.
Why did you get offered that scholarship? The whole thing is so cynical, right? You've been offered this scholarship so that you can make them feel better, A, and B, so that they can present a better face to the world.
Right.
Not always, but often you will have lower SAT scores and lower GPA than your white classmates, you will know it and they will know it.
And it'll be quantifiable. I think the dropout rate for Black students was like 20% higher.
Exactly. So now it's very difficult. You find it much more difficult to pass your classes, to get good grades in your classes than your white classmate. Simultaneously, you're reading and inundated with history of slavery, which they start to teach seriously in college, slavery and Jim Crow and apartheid South Africa, and now Black Lives Matter and police brutality, very, very real things. And there's a tendency in college to want to identify with the great social movements of the time, right? And in history, there's that too. That plays into this as well. And you see a lot of this in the kids now. They're obviously identifying, very self-consciously identifying with movements of the past, right?
There was a professor. You put this video on your Facebook page, and I'll link it in the show notes because it was really worth the hour to watch it. It was two black Ivy League college professors, Lowry and the other guy,
John McWhorter,
who's been like the center of a whole bunch of controversy for basically saying that Black Lives Matter is stuck in the past. They're stuck in 1965.
Not entirely. He doesn't dismiss Black Lives Matter.
But he says that, you know, they're envisioning, I think it's similar to what you said, that they're envisioning a situation that doesn't really quite exist anymore.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Now, again, once again, there are absolutely no question in my mind, it's obvious that there are scientific racists in this country. It's just that they operate exclusively in places like Yik Yak and Reddit.
Yeah, okay.
Right? They do not, at least they can't express themselves publicly in the halls of Congress, in the White House, on CNN, even on Fox News. I mean, that you cannot express scientific racism in this country and be unpunished. Okay, that's just a fact.
Okay, they're marginalized, sure.
Yeah, so there's no system, and certainly in high, now I am very, very sympathetic to the argument that there is such a thing as systemic or structural racism in certain sectors of American society today, right? The prison system, the criminal justice system, right? Dealing with a cop on the street, you know, catching a cab in New York City. I know there's endless debates about why cab drivers don't pick up black people, but they don't. And I know there's endless debates about the exact causes of why you're more likely to get pulled over by a cop if you're black than if you're white. But that does happen. Okay. There are 1 million black people in prison. There are not 1 million white people in prison. Well, about the same numbers, but of course there's like only 12% of the population is black. We all know this, right? Grossly disproportionate. Okay. There you have an argument for sure. Those are particular contexts. Those are particular sectors of American society in which there's a really clear set of discriminations, right, based on race. Higher education is particular, by the way. These are almost all elite schools. You may have noticed, like, this is all high-level schools. This is not the state schools, right? Not community colleges where this is happening.
Right.
Elite colleges and universities in American higher education now ain't those sectors. These are very different, very, very different contexts, very different sectors of American society. In higher education, paternalism is dominant. Scientific racism, violent segregationism virtually don't exist. You know, okay, we can say, let's take it, I am even skeptical of these claims, but let's just say it's true that there were two students at Missouri yelled or used the word nigger in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that. I'm even skeptical of that, but let's say that's true. Okay. That's two guys. That's clearly not structural or systemic because there are 35,000 students on that campus. There 5 years ago at Missouri, two white students, I don't know if you know this, did put cotton balls on the lawn in front of the black student center.
Okay.
Pretty racist.
Yeah.
Can't argue with that one, right? About 5 years ago this happened. Okay. Is that evidence of structural racism? It would be if the structure, the institution, condoned it. What happened to those two kids? They were expelled immediately and then prosecuted.
Yeah, but there's workarounds. I don't want to jump ahead, and I don't want to step on you, but you know, I do feel a lot of frustration about this, and I'm seeing these workarounds develop. But there's a lot of collectivism, both in this camp and in the people who might oppose it for racist reasons, that I find really gross, saying things like all white people are to blame because of silence. Right. So now if there's silence on campus, like what happened at Dartmouth, and I think that even though this was a very kind of raucous and emotional, students went into the library, black and white students went into the library chanting Black Lives Matter. There's video of this. And people who didn't stand up and start chanting we're still chanting humans. I can't believe it. But people who didn't start chanting were interrogated. So now silence is complicity, and if there's enough silence, then that's scaled up to structural racism, it seems. That's the trend that I see. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, it's actually a little bit worse.
Oh, okay.
It's, the slogan is silence is violence.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're doing violence by being silent.
Right.
Which is sort of, to me, a perversion of French post-structuralism, which you and I have debated on this very show. The idea is, which basically comes from French post-structuralism, which is that, you know, all power is discursive. And so to them, how they've interpreted that is that discursive violence is equivalent to physical violence, right? And if that's true, then any means are justified to defend oneself from the former, from discursive violence, right? So that means if discursive violence is equivalent to physical violence and silence is discursive, which it is, according to me, I believe that, Foucault believed that too, then the violence is all around you. It is always an imminent threat, right? And it must be stopped by any means necessary. So all the kids in that library who were being quiet, according to that theory, which the logic of it is consistent, okay, were doing violence to those people, right? I know it's crazy on one level. I'm not defending it. I think it's a perversion, and I think it's very, very dangerous.
Perversion is a good word. Okay.
I am in no way defending it. I'm just trying to explain the logic of it, okay? Because what I really, really want to do more than anything is intervene intellectually in this stuff, and that's not what's being done, okay? I want to understand it, not dismiss it, even though I have been really, really upset with a lot of what's gone on for personal and political reasons. I still want to try to understand it. And the first thing that I started this conversation with is you've got to understand why there might be quite a bit of anger among Black students on college campuses today. I understand on one level, I get the sort of typical conservative reaction to them, which is, you motherfuckers have scholarships to Yale University. You are not in the 1% globally. You're in the 0.001%, and you're complaining about Halloween costumes. I completely get that argument, that criticism, that irritation. But you got to understand, these kids are plucked out of these neighborhoods, put on these in these white, they're basically white institutions, they are. Then they're not often, not always, but often not prepared to compete in those institutions. And on top of that, and this is completely true, they're expected, this is their function, they have a function. They're expected to represent their race.
Okay.
That's why they're there. That is the logic of racial paternalism, of racial liberalism. That's exactly why they're there. All the arguments about affirmative action and diversity on campus were about diversity actually benefits white people, right? Because it gives them experience with people outside their cultures, right? So this is explicit. So those Black kids are actually serving a function, and the function is to enrich and educate the white kids around them.
Yeah, it's a more sophisticated version of my Black friend.
Yeah, but so that's why they're there. That's why they're getting paid to be there, okay? Now, I hope you can understand, I hope your viewers and listeners can understand why that might get on your fucking nerves, right? Mm-hmm. And every class, right, usually there'll be one or two Black kids in the class, right? And everyone's super conscious of them, nervous about them. And then on top of this, there's another thing I see all the time, and it drives me crazy. Faculty in particular, but students too, will not argue with them, will not contradict them, will not challenge them because they're afraid of being called racist. Now, that's not the fault of the Black kids necessarily, because the Black kids haven't even said anything yet. But there's this tremendous fear of being labeled that. Right. So the Black kids get, so this is patronizing, right? Is another word that's very useful in this. It's very, very patronizing. They get treated the way adults treat children. When my son walks in and says he saw Santa Claus on the roof, right? I don't say that's scientifically impossible, Toby. Santa Claus does not exist. Here are the five reasons you're wrong, right? Mm-hmm. I say, really? You saw Santa Claus? Oh, that's interesting. Right. That's the way Black kids are treated on campuses.
Absolutely. So let's go back to what you said one of your goals was. And I could see from the way you were talking about it that I think that even though we're coming from different places, those goals line up, and that's engaging with this intellectually. It's very easy. And that's why I wanted to start with the term. You use that term, you can dismiss it like that, and it's gone. This whole thing. These people are fucking idiots. Goodbye.
It's
right? No, but that's what's happening. Right? So is it still possible You know, when you talk about that placation as basically a system or a very, very common practice for the faculty in these schools, is it possible to engage with this intellectually in a meaningful way? You know, those two professors, one from Brown and the other from Columbia, Laurie and McWhorter, they were talking about this and they kind of laid out a framework in which they wanted to explore this. And they talked about, you know, principles, psychology, and pedagogy. And so in the principles, they say it really comes down to free speech versus inclusion, right? So free speech will go away in favor of inclusion, which is basically what we saw at Yale with Halloween costumes and cultural appropriation. I mean, that's an example of it.
Yeah.
In pedagogy, the teaching, it was basically comfort versus enlightenment. So maybe we can do some enlightenment as long as we make sure everybody is comfortable first. I forget who the professor was. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. But he wrote an article, I think it was last year, wrote it anonymously, saying, I'm a liberal professor, but I'm afraid of my liberal students who are combing through my syllabi looking for things that are upsetting and unsafe to them to have them removed. Yeah. And then the psychology is all just placation. So in that environment, how I'm interested in what you think the forward path is here, because I'm very interested in it, and obviously I want to deal with this in a more mature way than what I see happening online. But I'm also pretty frustrated by what I've seen.
Well, I mean, higher education needs a revolution for one thing. I'm interested in subverting it from top to bottom, and I do actually think there will be. I think higher education in America will look very, very different in 10 years. And I hope to be a part of that. But in the meantime, here's one thing that will happen, I'm pretty sure, because I've seen some evidence of this, but it makes perfect sense to me. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's a very good thing if it does happen. Historically, Black colleges and universities will benefit greatly from this. I've seen some evidence that they're already getting more enrollment because of it. I think HBCUs are great. I think they should be supported. And by the way, I think conservatives and libertarians should be all about HBCUs.
Can you define that abbreviation?
Historically Black colleges and universities, HBCU.
Okay.
Okay. So these are colleges and universities that were established, most of them established during Reconstruction or in the late 19th century. Then they were mostly vocational, but they become institutions of higher education just like any other. It's just that they're predominantly Black. Some of them are entirely Black, and most of them are at least predominantly Black. None of the crazy pressures on Black kids exist there that exist at white schools, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, they don't have to lower standards to get Black kids in the door. They don't expect Black kids to represent their race in class all the time, or at least not in the same way. I think they're great. And then we have quite a bit of empirical data to show that graduates of HBCUs are happier and do better financially and otherwise than Black graduates of other schools. Pew Research just came out with a poll just a few months ago showing this. But we have quite a bit of empirical data. Loyola University, is it Loyola College? I forget. There's a Black college in New Orleans that has a very good medical school, and some huge percentage of Black doctors in the United States are graduates of it. Martin Luther King went to Morehouse and HBCU. We have a whole list of very, very accomplished alumni of these schools. Howard University is the most famous and most prestigious in Washington, D.C. Everyone's heard of that. Spelman is the women's college in Atlanta. Morehouse is the other in Atlanta. Those are the top three. But they put out a tremendous number of very accomplished graduates who, by the way, operate in integrated environments after college, right? These are not people who just go off to form some Black separatist commune, right? These are people who operate in medicine, in education, become astronauts. I mean, it's intellectuals of all kinds. I have many friends who have gone through Howard, Spelman, or Morehouse who have done fantastically well in integrated environments as professionals. So I think that's the way to go. I think that's one very good thing that will come out of this.
Why did you say that conservatives and libertarians, why do you feel like they should be supportive of that?
Well, for one, it gives choice, right? Mm-hmm. It gives to Black kids. They don't really have the problem with integration. One of the problems with integration is that it deprived a lot of very thriving Black institutions of customers. So, you know, the Negro Leagues, for instance, you know, were great and were this wonderful showcase for Black athletes. and black baseball fans loved the Negro Leagues, et cetera, they died when integration happened. There were black, thriving black business districts in every southern city until the 1960s, and now they're all boarded up. And the HBCUs were one casualty of integration, right? Because until the 1950s and 60s, they pretty much had the market cornered on black talent.
Yeah.
Well, if you're a black, intellectually gifted person now, it'd be a little bit silly to go to one of the HBCUs because they're underfunded. I mean, you're just not going to get the kind of training most likely at an HBCU as you would at Harvard or Yale, who will give you full rides, by the way. So I think it's, oh, so there's choice. You know, if we have thriving HBCUs, we have choice for people. School choice, we like that, right? Market choice, we like that too.
Yep.
And the idea of cultural separation is something that Rothbard was into. And I think he had a point on that. The idea of forced cultural integration is a progressive idea, which conservatives and libertarians should oppose. It's coercive. Yeah, it's coercive, right? And it also, it's an attempt to homogenize the world. It's an attempt, in this case, it's always been an attempt, really, to make black kids white. And now I know some libertarians and conservatives do like that part of it, but I sure don't. So anyway, I think I'd like to see conservatives and libertarians take a look at HBCUs. I think they should be sympathetic to it.
Okay, so let's go from a bigger picture to a smaller picture. Like, let's go to your classroom.
Okay.
How mixed are your classes, would you say? Or does it vary? Or could you make a general rule for it?
Not very, even though Occidental is technically one of the most diverse colleges in the country.
Mm-hmm.
They keep telling us that 40%+ of our students are of color, although I think those numbers are cooked because I don't see it in my classrooms.
Yeah, you could expand the definition of color.
You know, they include, like, I have a kid right now in one of my classes whose, like, father is Indian American, his mother's white, and I'm sure he's counted as of color.
Yeah.
Even though his name is Nadelman and, you know, whatever. So out of like 20 kids, you know, I guess I'd say usually there's like, I have one or two black kids and then two or three Latino kids.
All right. Well, considering the follow-up question, it might not even really matter that much because we're not just pinning this quest for social justice on minorities, right? It's for everybody. Have you gotten in any more trouble with narratives like, Caucasians come to America and are considered black until they earn their whiteness, or some plantation owners thought the slaves were too free?
Yeah, right. So I do. Anyone who's familiar with my work at all knows that I have some things to say about slavery that don't fit the dominant narrative. I am hyper careful about setting up that argument before they read it. So I do at least one entire preparatory class just sort of preparing them for my argument about slavery before they read that chapter. Also, it usually comes, I'm actually doing it next semester, it usually comes, I don't know, several weeks into the semester, and they've already gotten a sense of who I am and the bigger ideas that inform that chapter.
So you have some rapport. It's not just, day one, you jump out from behind the podium with this, right?
It's not just reports that the slavery chapter is part of a much broader, you know, intellectual framework.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you understand it as part of that, you see that the framework is not racist. In fact, it's anti-racist. In fact, it at least claims to be sort of populist, right? Just anti-elite and all these good things, right? So when you see the slavery chapter argument as being part of that, it's much more palatable for these people.
All right.
So I have amazingly gotten no pushback on the slavery stuff. I've been teaching it. I've taught it in about at least five classes so far, and I've gotten almost no pushback on it, shockingly. And I've had black kids in every one of those classes. And not just black kids, it's lots of white progressive kids too.
Sure. Now I want to come back to that, and I want to end there because I want to tie that into what's going to happen next at Occidental, as much as you can talk about it with your mandatory diversity training. But first, let's go a step further into what young people who are being introduced to a lot of this might consider offensive. Are you familiar with the work of Jared Diamond?
Slightly.
So I'm actually, just if you'll bear with me a second, I'm just pulling up his Wikipedia. I wanted to read about one of his books, and he is also someone who's caught a lot of shit. second and best known popular science book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fate of Human Societies. So just in a nutshell, and I think this was mentioned during that discussion between Lowry and McWhorter as well, there's this absence of scientific discussion because of the sensitivity or the fear of what will happen. So somebody like Jared Diamond, who makes this argument, and I'll just read it for people who are totally unfamiliar, says about the book, it asks why Eurasian peoples conquered or displaced Native Americans, Australians, and Africans instead of vice versa. It argues that this outcome was not due to biological advances of Eurasian peoples themselves, but instead to features of the Eurasian continent, in particular, its high diversity of wild plant and animal species suitable for domestication and its east-west major access that favored the spread of those domesticates, people, and technologies for long distances with little change in latitude. All right. So this is dismissed as racist because the argument is that race has no biological basis. The idea is a social construct. And therefore, people like Jared Diamond, who, from what I've gathered, I mean, I've just started looking into his stuff in the last couple weeks, can be completely dismissed as making like neo-scientific racist arguments.
I don't see how that's racist at all, his argument. It's an argument about topography and flora and fauna being determinative, not human races.
Right. The argument against it was that it establishes a biological basis for race, that people coming from different places shaped by different biologies means that race is not purely a social construct.
I mean, I haven't read the book, but the way you described it, and I've read summaries that sound like yours. It doesn't sound like that at all. I think he's trying to explain why Europe became economically and militarily dominant, right? That's why.
Sure.
And his argument, it sounds like, has nothing to do with human beings, actually. The basis of it is in the soil and the animals and the plants there.
Yeah. Right? So I guess a simpler question, especially if neither of us are terribly familiar with the work, would be, is too much stuff getting caught in this net of the label scientific racism?
So race is absolutely a social construct, if you ask me. But that's another, I mean, we've had that argument elsewhere. So
for people who haven't heard it, can you just explain that case?
The idea that there are biologically distinct and hierarchical races of human beings was invented at a particular time in a particular place. America and Northern Europe in the 18th century. Before that, you just don't see people with these ideas very much. It's pretty scattershot. I mean, there's some, you know, reactions to the dark color of Africans, but they don't have these ideas about Africans being of this particular race. And they certainly didn't have ideas until much later of Jews and Italians and Irish and Slavs and Greeks being of distinct races either, right? So you see people coming and going in and out of these new categories of races, right? Races get constructed and then deconstructed constantly in history, which tells you that it's not fixed and there isn't really any truth about it, right? So as you know from my book, Jews for about 50 or 60 years were considered to be a different race than Caucasians, right? And some people thought they were black, and some people thought they were just a different race, and some people thought they were part ape. Mm-hmm. And now they're just white, just like you and me. Same with the Irish, same with the Italians, same with Slavs, same with Greeks, same with, you know, Egyptians. They've all occupied separate races in particular times in history. Okay, so then where is race? It's clearly arbitrary. It's clearly an arbitrary designation that's invented here and there. Another argument, and this is not so much an argument, but like I guess it causes consternation in anyone who believes in race as biology. According to our ideas of race, American ideas of race, a black woman could not give birth to a white baby, but a white woman can give birth to a black baby.
Yep.
Isn't that weird? Right? In Brazil, they have a three-tier idea of race, so that there are blacks and there are mulattoes and there are whites. We don't have that. You're either black or you're white. What in our way of thinking, and the American way of thinking, what makes someone black?
Having at least one black parent?
Nope. it's a much lower bar than, come on, it's a much lower bar than that. Well, I mean, having any ancestor at all from Africa.
Ah, yes. Okay. Right? Agree.
So
agree.
Your great, 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 great grandfather was African. And everybody else in your family, every other person was from Norway. You're black.
Yeah.
It's obviously absurd, right? So how is that person a different race than me?
I gotcha. Yeah.
It's one absurdity after another. And then it's one historical contingency after another, right? So in other words, our ideas of race change constantly too. And so the four chapters in my book are devoted to that, right? How our ideas about the race of the Jews and Italians and Irish changed over time quite radically, not in small ways, right? The Irish went from being chimpanzees to being black to being white, not just white, but Nordic white, the best white.
Right.
In the space of 100 years, right? And the Jews and Italians went through essentially the same process.
So the reason why I asked is that this is just something that I've begun to research, and very initially from different perspectives, not with any agenda. You know, I just hear these race and IQ arguments or thing, and I just want to investigate them. The same reason why I see this whole SJW thing, my initial reaction is disgust and being pissed off, and I want to learn more because I don't want to feel that way about anything. So I'm in a similar place with what is, I think, a very vocal counter to a lot of this racial justice awareness that's being raised on college campuses and on the internet. So those are my goals at this time.
Yeah.
It's just to explore it more. I do think there's some validity to the idea that, you know, people who originate close to the equator would not need the same level of problem-solving skills to survive as people who lived in Norway. But
that could just be cultural adaptation, right?
Well, yeah. That's what I'm saying. I'm a beginner, and I wanted to get your thoughts, and maybe we can revisit that in the future. Last question before I let you go. What's going to happen at Occidental? How are you going to deal with it?
We didn't even talk about the demands of the student protest.
I'll put that at the beginning of the show.
Which are mostly quite bad. Or I don't know. Many of them are very, very bad. The demands at Occidental, well, it wasn't even demands. This is the most depressing part, was the faculty, a group of faculty, took it upon themselves to propose in a mechanism by which students can report microaggressions committed on them by faculty.
Yeah, this is all the placation, I think, that you were speaking about.
Surveillance system, basically. Nightmare. A black studies department, fine. And trying to remember the other one that was particularly egregious. Some language that basically suggested strongly that we would be obligated to give higher grades to black students.
Interesting.
I didn't go to this meeting. The faculty debated it last week. They tabled it. And so the discussions are ongoing. I just heard that none of the really bad stuff will be passed. But there's a significant portion of the faculty who favors them.
Interesting.
I missed one. You mentioned it, the mandatory diversity training for all faculty.
You alerted all of your followers last week that you were about to be found guilty of structural racism.
Yeah, that was slightly tongue-in-cheek, although not really. So this proposal that the faculty was going to adopt stated in the preamble that the faculty as a whole were complicit in the structural racism of the college.
Yeah.
Which includes me. So it included me, right?
They
were declaring us all guilty of it, that's what I was suggesting.
Well, I can flesh all that out a little bit better in the introduction or the postscript to the show. I know you're tight on time today, so I want to say thank you very much for joining us. Again, it's always a pleasure to have you. The people will be so excited to see your name in the feed again. And this is a huge topic. This is obviously, if I may, a war with several different theaters. And we really just focused on one of them in this show, but there are several others. And I hope that if you have the time in the near future, we could continue this conversation. I got a lot out of it, and I appreciate your time.
Sure thing, Brett.
Wow, that was a great f***ing show. And right now, this project needs your support to make more f***ing great shows like this possible. please go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and sign up to be a monthly contributor. Hey, do you love Thaddeus Russell? Of course you do. It's either that or you hate him. And you don't strike me as one of those people. So jump in the AV Club where you can hear him interview me about the history of School Sucks Podcast. And that's just one of hundreds of pieces of interesting additional content you will find there. So yes, please, we need your support right now at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. Thanks for listening, everybody. And I hope you found today's show valuable.